So we're in Luke chapter 6. Last time we saw Jesus and his encounter with the religious experts. We saw how he was really redefining a religion, that he was challenging and correcting them in the way they approach God, that the old way of doing things just wasn't sufficient to cope with the new life, the new work that Jesus was doing. And there is a sense in which this morning Jesus carries on in a similar vein. Here he's displaying his authority as he shows his authority over the Sabbath. So what's the Sabbath? That's the first thing we need to get to the bottom of. For the Jews, Sabbath was the last day of the week. What we would call Saturday. It was a day that God commanded them that they were to give over to him. In some religions and some cultures, you have lots of kind of sacred objects, images and statues, things that are holy, that mark off where God is at work. But for Israel, what really marked them out as distinct and different was not so much sacred things, but this sacred time. That there was a day that they were to devote to God. And just as they had circumcision as a mark in their body of belonging to God, of their covenant relationship to him, here the Sabbath was a mark in their whole life, if you wish, a mark in their calendar that showed that they belonged to God, that marked them out, that made them distinct. And yet, somewhere along the way, that Sabbath instruction got twisted. Where God had told them they were to do no ordinary work, that it was to be a special day. This great council of rabbis had sat down together and come up with this long list of things that you couldn't do. 39 categories that you were forbidden from doing on the Sabbath. You couldn't light a fire. You couldn't cook your vegetables. You weren't allowed to chop a salad. You weren't allowed to harvest, to reap food. You weren't allowed to thresh it. You weren't allowed to winnow it, to separate good from bad. If you had a bowl of nuts and raisins, you couldn't make two separate piles, because that would be sorting. But you were allowed to eat the ones you wanted, but leave the ones you didn't, because that was okay. It became, well, it seems to us farcical, doesn't it? If you, Orthodox Jews still are bound by these rules. They have to try and work out how to apply it in the modern world. They end up with a situation that you can open the fridge door, but only if the motor is already running, because otherwise you'll be causing work. You can turn on an LED light because it doesn't get hot, but you can't use an old-fashioned incandescent bulb. The adding of rules and complexity to God's good instruction and design. And before we feel too self-righteous about that, how often do we add Sabbath, you could a break in order to save life. You would stop someone dying, but you couldn't heal them. But yet, as I say, Sabbath originally is God's good design. It's the giving of rest. It's what we need. It's the setting apart of a day for God. A day that particularly can be used in worship. Of course, we don't meet on a Saturday. We don't observe Sabbath. The early church saw that Sabbath was replaced by Sunday, the Lord's Day, Resurrection Day. So we come on a Sunday, not a day covered by a thousand different regulations and little laws. But it is to be a day that's devoted to God. A day when we don't do those ordinary other things. So there are exceptions, things that need to be done. But a day that we give back to God. It's not that we kind of meet on a Sunday and we have our service quite early, don't we? 10 o'clock, so we can get it out of the way and get on with the rest of our lives. No, God is the giver of everything, the creator of all. Every day is his day, really. But he asks particularly that we would devote 1 in 7 back to him. It's not a chore. God, in fact, promises a blessing that goes along with that. On a very practical level, you and I need rest. If we had no Sabbath, if there was no reason to break it, we would just carry on and grind ourselves down. The Creator knows you. It is wise to follow the manufacturer's instructions so as to get the best out of whatever it is we're dealing with. And the Maker knows that you need rest. In Isaiah, God teaches us that there is a relationship between delighting in the Sabbath, delighting in the day given to him, and delighting in God. This is what is written in Isaiah 58. If you keep your feet from breaking the Sabbath, and from doing as you please on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the Lord's holy day honorable, and if you honor it by not going your own way and not doing as you please or speaking idle words, then you will find your joy in the Lord. And I will cause you to ride in triumph on the heights of the land and a feast on the inheritance of your father Jacob, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Do you see that? If you call the Sabbath a delight, if you make it a good thing to give over to him, rather than a duty and a chore, then you will find your joy in the Lord. You are unlikely to delight in God unless you delight in his day. Well, that's what the Sabbath is. But we have two instances here where Jesus is at work on the Sabbath. Two instances where he comes up against the religious leaders, the Pharisees. The first one is this Sabbath day. He's going along. They're walking through the cornfields with his disciples. And what are we told? They begin to pick some ears of corn, to rub them in their hands and to eat the grain. And the question is asked, why are you doing what is lawful on the Sabbath? What do you think you're up to? Now, they don't say, why are your disciples stealing that grain? They weren't. So back in Deuteronomy, God had given this provision so that nobody would be hungry. If you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you can eat all the grapes you want, but don't put any in your basket. If you enter your neighbor's cornfield, you may pick the ears with your hands, but you must not put a sickle to his standing corn. You see, if you're hungry, you can eat. You're out for a walk and you see the blackberries. You can't jump into your neighbor's orchard and fill your basket. But you can have a Braben. God is providing for them so that they wouldn't be hungry. And so what Jesus' disciples is in line with that. There they are, they're walking through the cornfield and they're just picking up some corn. They're just eating the grain. But, you know, I said about those strict rules, you couldn't harvest. You couldn't thresh. Grind the grain. You couldn't winnow it, separate out the wheat and the chaff. You couldn't prepare food. And here they are, and they're picking, and they're rubbing them together, and they're blowing off the chaff, and then they're eating the grain. And as one of the commentators says, there are four distinct breaches of the Sabbath in one mouthful. What are you doing? You're not allowed to do this. Now, how does Jesus respond to them? He doesn't say, away with you, don't be so daft. He turns and he talks about David. Well, that's interesting. So the story is, David is running away from King Saul. And David turns up at the tabernacle. He hasn't got anything to eat, and he hasn't got a sword. And he asks the priests, can you help me out? Have you got any bread? And they say, we haven't got any. The only bread we've got here is holy bread, special bread, the showbread, this bread that's on display in the tabernacle as a part of their worship. You might think like communion bread, but it's not just that, because only the priests were allowed to eat it. The common people couldn't. And Jesus turns to David. But Jesus is not just using this biblical argument, this example, if you like, to support him. I think Jesus is going deep on this. Because Jesus is looking to David. And who's David? David is God's chosen king. David is God's royal servant. David is the kind of prototype Messiah. And Jesus is saying, look, if David can do this, not then I can get away with it. If David can do this, how much more I? Because I, he says, the Son of Man's a name that Jesus uses himself. It seems a bit ordinary, but it carries along with it connotations of divinity, of his godness. The Son of Man, he says, of the Sabbath, it's his authority. Just last time when we were looking, we saw in verse 24 of chapter 5, the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. He's using this name uniquely because of the significance of it. He's claiming this authority. The Son of Man, he says, is Lord of the Sabbath. I have authority over the Sabbath, says Jesus. I get to say what it's about. It's God's day. It's the Son of Man's day. Well, therefore, Jesus is claiming, isn't he, that he's God. It's mine. So there's the grain. Jesus is saying, I get to define the Sabbath. I get to go above and beyond David because I'm great David's greatest son. David points forward to Jesus. And then we're told about another Sabbath, another time. We don't know where it was, but we know on another Sabbath. And Jesus goes into a synagogue, and we heard before that it was Jesus' custom to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath, to delight in God, to give the day over to him, to honour him in that. And Jesus is teaching. And we're told that in the synagogue there's a man with a shriveled hand. Some people think maybe he's a plant. Maybe the Pharisees have put him there on purpose to see what Jesus will do. Some people wonder if Luke is using this idea of the man's shriveled hand because he wants us to see the kind of atrophy, the shriveled up state of the Jewish spiritual life at this time as is being kind of unfolded in this little cluster of stories. And being disabled. In this culture, they would have presumed that somehow the man was under God's curse. That this was somehow God's judgment on him. That his hand was shriveled up, that he was suffering in this way, that he wasn't right, and it was because God was against him. And presumably he must have done something to bring it. So not only is he suffering in that his hand is shriveled, his right hand, as well as the problem that brings to him, there's the kind of shame and the being ostracized that would go along. And we meet the Pharisees, and they are there, and they are looking, we are told, for a reason to accuse Jesus. They are looking for a reason, so they watch him closely. We've seen in these, in chapter 5 and 6, this kind of building opposition to Jesus. The Pharisees are against him. Previously they'd sit and listen while he's teaching. Then the next story, they were complaining about his behavior. Why are you eating with these people? Why aren't you washing properly and fasting? And now they're looking out for the chance to get him. Just as in chapter 5, Jesus knew what they were thinking in verse 2. Jesus has this insight, men's hearts. And he asks a question. What is it lawful to do on the Sabbath? Is it right to do good or is it right to do evil? God's day, what's it for? For doing good or for doing evil? Verse 10, he looked round at them all. Do you see the tables are turned? They're looking at him. They're watching him closely. But now he is looking at them. He is asking the questions. He is the one who is examining them. I don't know what you think about Jesus. Maybe you are examining him. Maybe you, in the weeks, months, years you have been coming, you have been hearing about Jesus, and you are weighing him up. You think you'll make a judgment on him. But you must see this. It is not we who get to examine him. He is looking at them now. He is the one asking the question. He one day will be the one who judges everybody. But it's a very incisive comment, isn't it? Jesus asks, is it lawful to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? And on one level, he's asking the question about the man with the shriveled hand, but on the other level, he's asking the question to people who are sat there in church plotting to kill him. Is it right to do good or to do evil? Now, Jesus' comment works on these two levels. It's incisive. But I want you to notice the way Jesus works with this man. Jesus knew what they were thinking. He said to the man with the shriveled hand, get up and stand in front of him. Here's a man. And perhaps he's used to being stared at. Perhaps he feels very, very conscious of this hand of his, shriveled up. That doesn't work. Maybe he spent his whole life trying to lurk in the shadows and trying, as he's talking to you, turning slightly, holding his hand down, putting it in his pocket so that you wouldn't see it. But here he is told, stand up where everyone can see you. And then worse, stretch out your hand. He's trying to hide his hand. That's the very last thing he wants, isn't it? It goes against every instinct he has. But you see, the last thing he wanted is the first thing he must do if he is going to be made whole. You see, to reach out his hand is an act of faith. What a crazy thing he told. Here's the man with the shriveled hand. Stretch out your hand. We have two doctors and a physiotherapist here. And thinking your dealings with people as they come in and they've got this awful condition. And the first thing you say to them is, do the thing you can't do. You see, the last thing he wants is the first thing he must do if he wants to be made whole. It's an act of faith. It goes against every instinct he has, but he must trust Jesus. He has to reveal his weakness, his deficiency. And we, if we are to be made whole by Jesus, we have to face our need. We have to recognize before Jesus our guilt, our sin, our brokenness, our inability. We need to face this harsh reality of our own neediness before him in order to receive wholeness. And if the man is thinking that by putting his hand in his pocket he can pretend there's nothing wrong with him, then he can never be whole. And as long as we are saying, there's nothing wrong with me, I don't need Jesus' help, I can straighten myself out. I'm okay, thank you very much. Do you see this? There's an act of faith here of confessing our need, owning our need. I broke down yesterday. I seem to be breaking down a lot at the minute. I broke down yesterday. There was this moment of wrestling as to whether or not I could get the car going or not. I came home on the back of a lorry. But before I could come home on the back of the lorry, I had to accept my need. I had to cry out for help. Well, call anyway for it. Do you see, as long as I'm stood on the side of the road thinking, I can get this one going, I'm stuck in mid-Wales, in the rain. It is only when I say, I am helpless, I cannot fix this, that I call on the one who can. Friends, that is what it is to be a Christian. It is to say that I can't fix this myself. And here's the man. And he can't hide it anymore. He's stood up in front of them all and he stretches out his hand. And he is made whole. He's taking a risk, isn't he? Can you imagine his fear? Stood there in front of them all, trying to stretch out the hand that doesn't stretch. It's risky. But it's rewarded. Costly for him. Much more costly for Jesus. He knows the Pharisees, he knows what they're thinking, he knows what they're going to do. And he goes ahead and heals the man. The wholeness that Jesus brings is costly to him. You know, the result of him healing this man is ultimately, they begin to discuss what they might do to Jesus. You see, the result of this wholeness that he brings us, and the cross is the way that he makes us whole. There's an incalculable cost, a cost that Jesus is willing. And here's the call then, that we would stand up, that we would face up to reality, that we would accept our need, that we wouldn't try to hide behind our respectability, our own sufficiency, that we would stand in front of Jesus with all our faults and our failings, with our sin and our guilt. And he has borne the cost, he has paid the price. Jesus here, as he did last time, confronts the religious authorities. This time it's about the Sabbath. One of the commentators puts it like this. He says, it might be your kind of Sabbath to leave men hungry and disabled, but my kind of Sabbath is different. Jesus is the true Sabbath. True rest is found in him. No more striving, no more working so that we could somehow get ourselves up to God, be acceptable to him, but rather resting on him. That our true relationship with God is that we would satisfy our hunger with not handfuls of grain, but with Jesus, the bread of life. That we would be healed, we would be made whole by the heavenly physician. So I would encourage you to think about Sabbath, about the way we rest, about the way we devote time to God, the way we spend this day, this Sunday, the way we rest, the way we worship. But more than that, you need to see that you need to rest in the one that the Sabbath, Jesus who feeds us and makes us whole. Father, we are people who need to be made whole. We are people who sin against you in a thousand ways. We are people who are bruised and broken and need healing. We are people who are hungry and need to be fed. We are people who are exhausted and rest. Father God, I pray that we would look to Jesus as our Sabbath and see that we have nowhere else to go. We pray it in his glorious name.